So first off, I just wanted to let everybody know that we are not having class next week due to Passover. But God willing, I will see you in 2 weeks. So just make a note of that. And let me make a note to post that on the chat so everybody knows what's up. Okay, amazing. Hi, Ellen. So we are moving along in our book of Proverbs. We are on chapter 20 and we are on verse 18. And we're going to be talking a lot today about our thoughts and our speech and the power of both of those things. It is interesting that a lot of the mitzvot of Passover are related to the mouth. One of the main commandments is to eat matzah. It's actually a positive biblical mitzvah to eat matzah on Passover night, at the night of the Seder, even though it's a mitzvah to eat matzah the whole week. But it's more specifically a mitzvah to not eat chametz the whole week, to not eat leavened bread. But the actual obligation to eat matzah is most significant on the first night. And then also the other mitzvah of the night is to speak. The Haggadah comes from the word lahagid, which means to tell. It's about telling the story of the Exodus. It's about telling our national story, passing it along to the next generation, but even telling it to ourselves. You know, this is our nation. This is where we came from. This is where we've been. This is what happened to us. This is what we've done. This is our story. This is who we are. This is who we will continue to be. So it's interesting that the two most significant mitzvot on Seder night is the matzah that we eat and the words that we speak, both of which are operated by our mouth. So that happens to be a big part of what we're talking about today. Welcome, Laura and Aaron. Nice to see you both. Okay. So we are on verse 18, which is page 210 and 211 in our book. And if you're using a different version, it's chapter 20, verse 18. Okay, so let us begin. Welcome, Nechama and Avril. Nice to see you both. Machshavot be'etza tikon. Thoughts are made firm by counsel. Firm meaning like well established. U'betachbulot aseh milchama. And with good strategies, wage war. So this reminds me of the expression loose lips sink ships. You guys know that expression. So if you have your word, this verse is talking about our thoughts and our strategies. That's how war is made, with thoughts and with strategies, right? If you think about it, it's kind of weird. You can have a bunch of hi Dana. You can have a bunch of people sitting around in a room, you know, the situation room, and strategizing and you know, sharing ideas and asking opinions and getting advice, and then that is going to determine the fate of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. It's really kind of mind-boggling, right? Now, what does this mean? That means that our words and our thoughts are very consequential. Sometimes people say to themselves, "Ah, what's the big deal? It's just words. I'm just talking." No. Words are what determine history and a person's fate, a person's life, the trajectory of a person's life. So our words are very, very significant, and we forget that at our own peril. So commentary says thoughts, machshavot, right? That's the first word, denote the full flow of ideas and notion in the mind. So let's say a person is sitting down for a brainstorming session, right? So the thoughts are is the full flow of ideas and notions in the mind, meaning you could have a million thoughts swirling around your head. Some of them are helpful, some of them are not helpful. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, right? It's like when you write a book, they say, you know, the first one is your quote vomit draft. Excuse the crude expression, right? Because you can't start censoring every single thing, or else you're never good at anything on paper. So first you sort of have to like throw up all your thoughts onto the paper. Afterwards, you can edit and censor and you know, pare it down. So that's machshavot, your thoughts. Million thoughts rolling around your head. Then the second half of the verse talks about Eitzah, Machshava Be'Eitzah. How does it become established? How do all those swirling millions of thoughts become established? Be'Eitzah, with counsel. Eitzah means advice. So counsel, Eitzah, means the single purposeful plan that is chosen from the many possibilities of the thinking mind. Okay, right? Hi, Tova. So when a person has a million thoughts, eventually, if you want to be successful, if you want to actually accomplish anything, you're going to have to distill those hundreds of thoughts into one thoughtful, laser-focused plan. You can't be all over the place, or you're never going to pick one right thing to do. Right? Hi, Lisa. So one example of this is, this is a very common thing nowadays with dating apps. Okay. Welcome, Leslie. You're upside down. Wow. How did you do that? You're hanging off the ceiling.
I have no idea. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
I
You're gravity defying today.
don't know what it is. Fits my day,
So,
though.
right, a person could say, "Oh, I have like a million opportunities. I how they say there's more fish in the sea. There's a million people that I could date, and that's what makes online dating so exhausting, from what I hear. Because there's so many possibilities, and there's a million supposed options, but actually, what you need is one practical, suitable option." You don't need a million maybes. You need one for sure. So, how do you distill all of those thoughts into one specific plan? Because that's the only way that you're going to actually get something done. So that's the first half of the verse. That's regular life, right? In regular life, not in wartime, in regular life, you have a million thoughts. You need to distill them into one clear plan, and then you follow that plan, and that's how things happen. Now we're talking about war. That's the second half of the verse. With good strategies, wage war. In war, however, many alternative strategies are needed to meet every contingency. So in war, you need to say, well, if the enemy does this, then we're going to do that. If the enemy does that, then we're going to do this. If this happens, then this. If it's raining, we're going to have to attack, here. And if this happens, then we need a plan B. You need a lot of different plans. I mean, when I think about what's going on in Israel right now, and the hostage deals that they keep trying to make, and I can't even wrap my head around how people are taking these kinds of decision making into their own hands that are so consequential and have such long-term ramifications for so many human beings. I do not envy anybody in that position of power to have to make life-altering decisions like this on a daily basis. I don't even know how people go about doing that. So hi, Maritza. Good to see you. So, therefore, you need many different plans. You need many different strategies. And if something doesn't happen, you have to pivot and go to plan B. And if that doesn't work, you have to pivot and go to plan C, including the leaking of information to the enemy, right? So, sometimes information is leaked to the enemy by mistake. Sometimes incorrect information is leaked to the enemy on purpose. There's all kinds of intelligence that goes on in a war, right? So, how does this apply to our life? Well, the first half of the verse is talking about normal times. In normal times, you need to have one clear path, and this is the path that you follow. But then sometimes in life, we come into crisis mode. And when you come into crisis mode, you have to be light on your feet and you have to be willing to pivot. Okay, you know what? Now it's crunch time. I can't do this. I can't do that. I have to triage. Our bodies, our physical bodies, which are created with such wisdom by Hashem, our physical bodies do this. When you need to have this burst of adrenaline to do something, your body suppresses your natural appetite and you're not hungry because you just have so much to do. Your body suppresses your natural fatigue because you have so much that you need to do. And then when the crisis passes, all of a sudden, your body allows itself to feel the fatigue again. All of a sudden, your body allows itself to feel hungry again. That's why a lot of times when something scary happens, you don't actually feel the terror until it's over. And then your heart starts to pound, and then your knees start to feel like jelly. And then all of a sudden, you can't breathe because your body knew that you needed all of your reserves at your disposal in order to face the crisis. And once the crisis has passed, then you can fall apart. Right. So this is, we have to understand that we have to, certain things are crunch time. I'm even now, it's Erev Pesach, right? It's right before Pesach. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of cleaning that has to happen. My daughter's not in school. There's a lot of cooking that has to happen. There's a lot of shopping that has to happen. There's a lot of home organization that has to happen. So, as I go through my to-do list, a lot of things I'm like, this is going to happen after Pesach. And this is going to happen after Pesach. You have to be light on your feet. You could have your plan, like it says in the first half of the verse. But you know what? Sometimes unexpected things are going to happen to mess with your plan. And if something unexpected happens to mess with your plan, you have to be able to not get stuck on your plan and say, what? No, but this is how it was supposed to be. But this is my plan. Well, sometimes you have to revise your plan and you have to have contingencies. Cindy.
Hi. So what this also reminds me is we have to be more empathetic for people during these times. And I did something about this, and I don't know if you're on the neighborhood watch, but somebody at Heinen's was supposedly robbed from her car. She was sitting in
Oh.
her car, somebody pulled up, grabbed her purse. But the comments were just so unsympathetic. It's like, why didn't she lock your dog? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do this?
Oh gosh.
Like, we just need to like simmer down and be like way more empathetic for people who are like struggling or not struggling or just handling things like in the moment. It's been very frustrating. It's been showing up a lot in my life personally, where like people are just like kind of, why didn't it, like the snappiness. And so I just think we have to be not, we have to be empathetic to ourselves as well. Like sometimes we make like rash decision in the moment and you just have to, say, okay, you're not a terrible person for making that decision. It was what you made the best decision at that scary moment or in that moment where like there was a little crisis,
Yeah.
which, and sometimes those crises don't turn out to be anything.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's really true. And I think a big takeaway from this verse too, and I've seen this so much in being an employer, and having people work for me. We have about 16 people on our staff, aside from our Sunday school staff. And I see that one of the best qualities in an employee, and I actually think I'm very good at this. It's something that I really have to pay attention to and work on, is the ability to be light on your feet and pivot when something has changed. Like, oh, okay, well, we planned this whole huge event, and now it turns out that it's conflicting with community event X, which we totally didn't know about. Okay, so you could either get stuck and glued to your plan and freak out and what? How can that be? No, stop. What are we gonna, or you could be like, okay. So what are we going to do? Let's move on. Let's do plan B. We're going to do it anyway. We're not going to do it anyway, So it's such an amazing quality in life to be able to have a plan and pursue your plan, but then not get overly stuck to that plan when something unexpected comes up. Because something unexpected is always going to come up. That's life.
And move away from the blame game.
Exactly, because it doesn't actually matter whose fault it is. Unless, again, if there's a specific employee or a person in the family who's constantly responsible for the mess ups, fine. Yes, that person might need to be dealt with. But overall, what's far more important than whose fault it is what are we going to do about it? And a culture of whose fault is it is a toxic culture.
Yeah. And even blame, yeah, this is this whole, I don't know, maybe it's social media these days, but it's like
Oh, for
this whole
sure.
blame,
Let's
just
blame
like,
social media.
yeah, it's their fault. But people just don't real like they it's so hurtful. It's so
Yeah.
hurtful. I think all of us are doing the best we can in the moment. Like nobody, none of us, especially none of us on this thing are, going around looking for ways to be, yucky people just for the sake of yucky people.
Yeah.
We know those people. Like we see them on social media too a lot these days. I'm gonna
Sheila, I love
mute.
what you wrote and welcome. A bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the turn. That's very good. I like that. Okay. So I think the best way to put this teaching into action is when you recognize it for what it is. Like, when something is happening and you could be like, oh, okay, so this is interesting because I had planned X, Y, and Z. And now this and that is happening, and this is messing. Okay, interesting. This is an opportunity for a pivot, And I want to be the kind of person who is flexible and who can work with unexpected circumstances and who doesn't get overly bogged down on how things were supposed to be, but rather on how they are. Like, as soon as you recognize what it is, okay, this is an unexpected thing. COVID was an unexpected thing. How am I going to pivot now? War in Israel is an unexpected thing. What am I going to do about it now? And on. Life is always going to hand you unexpected circumstances. And developing the resilience and the ability to roll with it is one of life's greatest skills. Okay. Good. Any questions?
Ruthie, this is what you said earlier in class. It reminds me of it. I was with Carly and Alex, who were in your teenage your college girl class, and they love you taught them we're not responsible for our first thought. And that's you were saying so many thoughts in your head, and they like that helped them so much. Like they that's like a thing in their life. So thank you.
That's great. That's great. I love that. Yeah.
Rocky, I have a question.
Sure.
I just thought about this. It's only four of us this year at our Seder. We're going to be in New York. And I thought maybe I'll set an extra chair for someone who might not be there. But then I thought that would make us sad. What's the halacha? Like, should we be happy? Should we be sad?
It's a good
Do we
question.
set an extra few chairs for people who couldn't be there?
It's a really good question. I'm going to punt the question over to Heather and Nechama, who were at our pre-Passover women's event this week, and we discussed this concept. Are you guys, Tova? Wait, Tova, were you there too? No, Lisa. No, I think just Heather and Nechama. Correct me if I'm wrong. So, are either of you guys in a position to share a thought on Sheila's question?
A therapist, maybe?
I mean, I think just the dichotomy of the holiday in and of itself means that the answer is both. Like, I think we are, we're talking about slaves and then we're talking about freedom, right? Which are like totally opposite experiences. And then I think it's totally appropriate to never forget that our hostages are still being held hostage, that our homeland is still at war. And so I feel like, I don't know, you could have a seat at the table and you're just like, this is for somebody who's not able to be at a Seder. And I'm proud that we remembered to do this. And I don't know, I don't think it has to be a sad thing, but that's
It's
just my.
an internal struggle.
Yeah.
So you have to
Yeah.
decide if you're going to win out or if you let them both hang out there for a while.
Right. I mean, on Shabbos, we've been saying a prayer for the soldiers. I know some synagogues read the names of the hostages like every Shabbos. I don't know if it's morning or evening, but I sort of just feel like it's both. That's
Okay.
my answer.
That's fair. Thank you.
Yeah. It's interesting that we bring up our loved ones who have passed at our happy occasions in Judaism. Like we say Yizkor on the holiday. We in there's a concept of inviting parents and grandparents who have passed to a wedding, right? And so the question is like, how is it appropriate to be sad during a happy occasion? Like, why would you do that? But you know what
Isn't
I'm
the breaking of the glass also what
Yes,
am I?
breaking the glass at a wedding, but that's specifically with remembering Jerusalem. And it's a mitzvah to remember Jerusalem in your happiest moments, that our joy is not complete while Jerusalem is not complete. But when
What
it
about the salt? Sorry, the
comes
salt on challah and Shabbos.
Yeah, that's something different. That's something
Oh.
different. But in terms of like, in terms of focusing on your relatives who have passed away, which is a very sad thing, right? Like, why would you do that? And it used to really bother me because I've been saying Yisker for a long time. And I'm like, why? Every time I say Yisker, I want to cry. And why would I cry on a holiday when there's a literal mitzvah to be happy? The Torah says, V'samachta b'chagecha, you shall be happy on your holiday. You know, and what I came to realize is that when you have a holiday or a simcha, you're thinking about your loved ones anyway. Of course you are. Of course they're on your mind. You know, whenever I go into my Passover Seder, I think of my grandparents because our holiday was all about my grandparents and now they're not here anymore. And when I'm walking my daughter down the aisle, I'm thinking of my father who's not here. So it's not so much that Judaism is telling you to be sad at your happy occasion. It's more that Judaism is being sensitive to the fact that you're thinking of your loved one anyway. And let's give you a commemoration and a symbolism to be able to bring that out. You don't have to stuff that down and say, no, I shouldn't think of my father. I should be happy. I shouldn't think of my grandfather. I should be happy. Of course you're thinking of your loved one. Of course, that's what the holidays bring up for you. So let's make a ritual out of it. And let's bring it out there and make it real. I think I didn't like learn this from any source. It's just something that I've been thinking about, you know, and I think the same thing is so true when it comes to, you know, like we were saying, you know, here the holiday is coming. Who would have thought that we would be going into another holiday and still be at war and still have the hostages not be returned to us? So what do you have to do? You have to pivot. Of course, we're thinking, how could you possibly be a thinking, feeling Jew with a beating heart and sit down to the Passover Seder this year and not be thinking about the hostages? How could you? So maybe let's just bring that out and make it a part of our celebration. Again, not in the sense of being sad, but in the sense of including those that we're anyway thinking about, including them in our ritual and in our tradition.
So I heard something. I was right after the war started, October 7th, and I was really unsure about what to do for Simchas Torah. And I went to Chabad, and I heard what the rabbi said, you know what, as Jews, we dance with our feet and we cry with our eyes. So we still do the motions. We still need to be b'simcha, and yet inside we're, you know, with so much pain and heartbreak. Wow. So we are living a dichotomy. I think Heather was saying about the dichotomy. I think that's just our life. You know, I mean, if you just think about everything as a Jew that we've had experienced throughout the generations in history, and look at prophets and read what we had to endure. You know, not just, you know, this century and lots of centuries ago. But we're still here. We're here still, still surviving, and we're here still leading and hopefully being a light to the nation. So we got to do what we got to do.
Very, very beautiful. We dance with our feet and we cry with our eyes. I love that. Thank you, Tova. Okay, let us move on to verse 19. Golesod holech rachil. He who goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets. Do not meddle then with one who sets his lips prating foolishly. Okay, so what we're talking about now, before we were talking about our thoughts and our plans, now we're talking about the power of our words. And actually, this ties in very closely to the Torah portion of the week, the Parsha. Last week, the Parsha was Tazria. This week, it's Mitzora. They're both very similar theme-wise. Most years, when it's not a leap year, those two parshas are read together. This year, they're read separately because it's a leap year. We have four extra weeks in the year. But it's about this person who's a chronic gossiper who develops this spiritual skin disease. In fact, in my Parsha class this week, for those of you who are locals, I'm going to be talking about five myths of Lashon Hara. So five things that you thought about Lashon Hara that are not actually true. Because the Talmud focuses very heavily on Lashon Hara, on negative speech around this Torah portion, because this is why this person would get this disease. People who would speak badly of others or who would walk around sharing people's stories with other people. And did you know this person did this and this person did that? And this person said this about you and this person is leaving their job and these people are getting divorced and these people are getting married and blah, 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 blah. Okay. So it's very related thematically to the, you know, to the Torah portion of the week. And in fact, I'll just read you the English of this verse again. He who goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets. Do not meddle then with one who sets his lips prating foolishly. So what this means is that a person who speaks without thinking, right? We said like, he who goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets, meaning it's not his intention to reveal secrets, But because he's a big talker, it's inevitable that secrets will be revealed. And the second part of the verse, do not meddle then with one who sets his lips prating foolishly. That means that you want to stay away from this person. Just don't engage in conversations. Don't share your secrets. Don't confide and don't trust this person, because inevitably something bad is going to happen. This person doesn't necessarily intend for bad things to happen, but when you speak foolishly, you speak without thinking, you speak thoughtlessly, it's inevitable that negative information is going to come through, whether it's revealing people's secrets or, you know, sharing bad things about other people. So the word for talebearer is rachil. A rachil is a peddler. So what does a peddler do? A peddler goes from community to community selling their wares, right? And why is this worth it for them? Because they get money in return. It's profitable for them. They gain something. So there's a mitzvah in the Torah that says, Lo telech rachil ba'amecha, that same word. Do not go about as a talebearer in your nation. So what does that mean? It means that a person, what is this person selling? It's calling him a peddler, but what is he selling? He's selling stories. So he'll tell this person, that person's news, and it's profitable for him because people are interested in what he has to say. It's gratifying. People are like, what? Are you serious? Oh my gosh, I can't believe it. You know, well, that can be very gratifying. You're the person who has the scoop. Everybody's listening to you. You know, like Lori Platnick says, you are the queen of the social moment. So this person, then it's, what does this person get from the other person? Yeah, then the other person says, and did you know, da 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 da. And then they take that information, right? They get it wholesale and they sell it retail. So then they go to somebody else and then they sell that story and they get more merchandise and they sell it to someone else. And they get more merchandise and on and on and on and on. And all the while, this person is creating havoc and drama. That's what it means to be a rachil. That's what it means to be a talebearer among your nation. The noun for this type of speech is rechilos. Rechilos means this kind of like tail-bearing gossip, meaning you're not necessarily saying negative information about someone. You're not saying, oh my gosh, so-and-so is such a jerk. That would be classic Lashon Hara, okay? What are you saying instead? Did you know that so-and-so said that you're a jerk? I'm not saying anything bad about you, but I'm just sharing a story. Somebody said that about you. Immediately, you've created negative feelings. Immediately. It's like when the eggs hit the frying pan, boom, it starts to sizzle. So this is the person who's just going around sharing stories. The second half of the verse says, just do me a favor, stay far away from this person. I know that that merchandise seems very enticing and it's very shiny and it sparkles and it looks fun, but ew, just stay far away from that person. That person is not going to take you towards your goals. Okay, the commentary says, we are warned to beware and keep away from people with loose tongues who are of three types. So now he's going to tell you there's three kinds of people in this category. And how he defines them is loose tongues. This means that these people speak without thinking through the consequences of their speech, right? If a person would take a moment and say, well, let's say that I saw something on social media and I call up my friend, like, could you believe that so-and-so posted this on social media, right? And I'm thinking to myself, what's wrong? I'm just sharing it. It's public information. They posted it for everybody to see. What if I were to think through the consequences of this? What's going to happen the minute I tell my friend this story? She's going to think badly of that person. And then we're probably going to go ahead and engage in a gossip fest because that doesn't surprise me because do you know what happened last week? Oh my God, no, please tell me what happened last week, you know, and it feeds on itself. So think about it. If you take a minute to think through, if I do this, what will happen next, right? But this person with a loose tongue is not thinking through the consequences of their speech. They're just very free with their words. They're not rationing their words. They're just spreading them about very freely to create a lot of damage. Okay, three types. Number one, the first reveals secrets and cannot be relied on. So this is a person that people confide in and they tell them confidential information. And they're like, listen, you can't tell anyone. The person's like, cross my heart and hope to die. I won't tell anyone. However, this person cannot be trusted because they'll just go to that one person and say, oh my gosh, I have to tell you something seriously, but you seriously can't tell anybody. So, you know, like I always say, they couldn't keep the secret, but now they're asking the next person to keep the secret. Well, that's really nice. Okay, so that's category one, is a person who cannot be trusted and who shares other people's private information. Category two, the second goes about as a talebearer and incidentally lets out secrets in the midst of his gossip. So this is a person, his intention wasn't to share a secret. He didn't call up his friend with the intent to share a secret, but just in the process of talking badly about others, the secrets spill out before they even realize what, oh my gosh, whoops, I wasn't supposed to say that, totally forgot. Okay, still bad. The third sets his lips prating foolishly. I don't even know what prating means, but it's a bad thing. And because he talks so much and so naively, secrets slip out. So it's not like in the midst of his negative talk, the secrets slip out. It's not even that he's trying to speak negatively. He's just speaking randomly, but he speaks so much and so naively. So this is a person who's just, you know, some people just feel like they always need to talk. They always need to fill the silence. They always need to chit chat. They always need to be saying something. And so sometimes the thing that they grasp to say is not a good thing. And then stuff comes out that shouldn't come out just because they're talking a lot. And the more you talk, the more likely it will be that some portion of your speech will not be positive speech. With all three, it is wisest not to meddle. Any of these three categories, right? The person who reveals secrets on purpose, the person who reveals secrets in the process of speaking negatively about others, and the person who reveals secrets just because he talks a lot. Any of these three, just do not get involved with a person like that. Just keep your distance from these people, since any strategy you have planned will be endangered. You cannot cure a person like this. It's a spiritual illness that this person needs to talk and talk and talk and talk, and it ends up that this person's speech is damaging. So just keep your distance. Do not share confidences with this person. Do not give them a listening ear. Do not give them an audience. Do not give them a platform. Just keep your distance. You're not going to cure this person. And if you try to go over to this person and say, no, you shouldn't have done that, da, 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 guess what? You're the next victim. Cindy.
Okay. Just for the sake of argument, I'm sure none of us have this, but there are people in our lives who are within close vicinity who you cannot get rid of. Like you can't, like, and they get upset when you follow these rules and you don't participate, then by even not saying anything or by stepping away or by changing the subject, you become the bad guy or like, or almost like not the bad guy, you almost become like the good guy, which is, you know, which is even worse sometimes. Like, oh, look, it's so good. Or they say like, why don't you share anything? You're so cold.
Yeah.
So just, I'm sure none of us have had this experience.
I want to validate that that is an extremely difficult position to be in because it feels like you can't win. If you engage, you lose. And if you disengage, you lose. So what should you do? Well, you can't make everyone like you. That's number one. And the goal isn't even to make everyone like you. The goal is to be a good person. And you have to try to have peace in your life. Sometimes people will like you for that. Sometimes people will dislike you for that. But the other piece is too, that there are people that you cannot create physical distance with, right? Like you were saying, they're in close proximity. They're in your life. But what you can do is you can create mental distance from these people. Meaning that you try not to let them get to you in your gut. It's very hard, but you basically, you're just creating like an emotional space where you try to create a zone that they can't touch you, you know? And if they say, why are you being cold or whatever, you have to realize that that's a manipulative tactic. Why is it so important to them that you engage in these activities with them? Why can't they just, you do you and I do me, and why isn't that enough? You know? So I don't know, like they're just not going to be happy with certain things, and that has to be okay. Even though, I mean, what I'm describing is very hard, you know, especially in some families, this is a whole culture where everybody engages in these kinds of conversations and everybody engages in this kind of, you know, communication. And if you're trying to be the lone wolf, you know what? I mean, the best I can suggest is to put it on you. Like, I'm uncomfortable. I'd rather not, you know. It reminds me of this biography that I read. It was written over 30 years ago. It's called Lieutenant Birnbaum. And it's about this religious Jewish guy from New York who joined the American army to fight against the Nazis. And his name was Lieutenant Birnbaum. His first name was not his first name, but they all used to call him Bernie. And you know, the soldiers, they would go out on Friday nights and drink and find girls and whatever, and they would always be like, Bernie, come and join us. Bernie, come and join us, you know. And his standard line was, it's not, that's not my cup of tea. He tried really hard not to moralize and not to be, you know, come off as superior, you know, but he knew that that was in violation of his spiritual values, and he wasn't going to do that. A, he wasn't going to go out on Friday night. He wasn't going to start drinking and messing around with girls. It's not who he was, you know, but he didn't want to make them feel like I'm better than you. So he just said, like, that's not my cup of tea, you know? So, you know, and some people, the people who are more understanding and respectful will live with that, you know, and the people who are less so will not live with that. And that's kind of like their problem, not yours.
It's interesting that you said you can't make others like you because there are two ways to read it. First, you can't make others to be like you, or you can't make others, and that's was
Right.
that's another thing that
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you. Hi, Debbie. Good to see you here. Yeah, these things are hard, you know. They are. They really are hard. Wouldn't it be nice if everybody learned Musser? But unfortunately, that's not the case. But the truth is, if everybody learned Musser, we would never have any work to do. So that would rob us of our opportunity for growth. So, you know, I remember a long time ago, I'm sure Heather remembers this because Heather's been learning Musser with me for a very long time. Like, you know, we always think of these people are my Musser work. You know, you're my Musser project, and you're my Musser project, and you're my Musser project. But little do we know that we are somebody else's Musser project. You know, we think of ourselves as being we're like the Musserniks. We're so spiritually evolved, you know. Well, guess what? Somebody else's internal work is because of us. I guarantee it. Everyone here, including me, I am somebody's Musser work. There's no question about it. Heather, do you remember us talking about that?
I think you spoke about your husband, that you were like, I mean, he used to like do these things that bothered me. And then I felt like I'm so growing because I just don't let it bother me anymore. And then it like dawned on you were like, wait a second. He never says anything to me about the things that I do that bother him. Like, oh my gosh.
Totally.
So for
Oh,
sure. And that's my husband too.
yeah.
For sure. Yeah. So funny. I say this to my clients all the time.
You mean that you might be somebody else's project? Somebody else is in therapy because of you. And you're in therapy because of them. Wow.
Exactly. So funny.
I love it.
Thanks for sharing. Great memory.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions on this very loaded topic? Lisa, you're muted. I don't know if you're talking to the group or someone else. Okay.
Ruffy, I think I know the answer, but even if you say something positive, that can be construed as like, oh, I have to tell you something great about this person. But maybe that person didn't want everyone to know that, you know, whatever it what engagement, let's just say, you know, as an example.
Yeah. So it really depends. So in general, saying nice things about other people is a mitzvah. And we should share positive impressions about other people. Except, and again, this all goes back to what I was saying before about thinking through the consequences of your words, right? So if you praise somebody in front of somebody else who doesn't like them, you have to recognize that that's going to engender a negative reaction in that person, right? Or we're, let's say two people are competitive with each other. Maybe they're competitors professionally, or maybe you have, you know, we are in this situation now in my family because we have a new son-in-law and we have an existing son-in-law. So now we have first son-in-law and second son-in-law, right? So what happens? My first son-in-law is very, very handy. He fixes everything around the house and he's super, you know, we say in Yiddish, geschickt. He's super capable and he can do anything. And before second son-in-law came into the family, we used to talk about him all the time. He'd be like, oh my gosh, Shia's amazing. Shia can fix everything. But now that I have another son-in-law at the table, I want to be careful not to overly praise my first son-in-law because I don't want to make my second son-in-law is newer in the family. I don't know yet what he's great at, you know, time will tell. But if you praise, if there's two sons-in-law in the family and you're praising one all the time, well, it could cause the other one to feel kind of inferior or bad. You know, you have to think about that. You know, if you have siblings around the table and you say, oh, this daughter helped me so much for Passover and made this and made that and whatever, you know, and then that person, you know, there's other people at the table who have not done so and they're going to feel bad about themselves or they're going to feel resentful of their sister. So you got to think these things through, even though in theory, praising somebody is a beautiful thing to do. But, you know, if you're praising them in front of somebody who might feel bad, resentful, competitive, or who might feel the need to speak up and say, oh, come on, it wasn't that big of a deal. Stop it. Like who might feel the need to deflate the praise or deflect the praise of that other person, you know, for whatever reason, whatever beef they have with that person. So then your Lashon Tov, your positive words are going to invite Lashon Hara, negative words. I know this all sounds very, very complicated and like basically you can't say anything, but it's not true. It just means that before you say something, you have to think to yourself, if I say X, what will happen? And you're not a prophet and you're not a fortune teller. You can only do your best, right? But some of it is common sense, you know? So you have to be mindful of the praise that you're giving, you know, or let's say.
And I think the person that you're talking about, because I'm thinking of a person who's so private, even in good stuff. And that's just who they are. So if I know that about them, you know, hey, is it okay if I tell my friends X? You know, I guess you do have to also know the person.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This has happened many times in our congregation where somebody in the congregation is ill and they're very private about their illness and they don't want people to know. So maybe they, you know, some people want people to know, they want people to pray for them. They want people to visit them. They want people to know about it. And other people are super private and they don't want anybody to know. So you might think you're doing a mitzvah by saying, hey, everybody, so-and-so is ill, please, you know, pray for them. But that person might just feel like their privacy was violated. You know, so again, it's just about thinking through like, and even if it's something like, oh, you know, so-and-so is opening a new business. Well, maybe they're not ready for that to go public. Maybe they're still working somewhere else and you could cause a tremendous amount of chaos by announcing their news before they're ready for it to be announced. Right. So, you know, these things are complex, but it really all boils down to one thing. First of all, check with somebody else before sharing their news and try to think ahead to the consequences of your words. That's really kind of what it all boils down to, you know? Okay. You know, and I also want to say, you know, we spend a lot of time in Judaism talking about negative speech, but I just want to say the power of positive speech. There's so much good that we could do with our words. The same way with one, you know, phrase or comment, you can really hurt people's feelings, but with one phrase and comment, you can really raise people up. A well-placed, sincere, and honest apology can be so, so powerful. A sincere and honest compliment can be so powerful. I was just telling Cindy about this. There's this system they have here in Cleveland now where you can order groceries online from this huge kosher grocery store in New York, and they do like a delivery once a week. And so I made a whole order for Passover. And the way it works is that you go to this like parking lot and at a designated time, and they have your orders. And they have all these like young guys packing up your car. So I went to pick up my order the other day. And one of my friend's sons, who's 20 years old, he's studying in a yeshiva in Israel and he's home for the holiday, and he was packing up my car. So we were chit-chatting and I thanked him and he's so cute. And as I was driving away, I was thinking to myself, you know, I should really just leave his mother a message and tell her how lovely he is and how mature and adorable and sweet and how nice it was to see him. So I left her a voice message and I was just like, listen, I saw your son and he packed up my order. And I just want you to know he's such a mensch and he's such a sweetheart. And it was so nice to see him and he looks really happy. You know, that took me 30 seconds. You know what powerful positivity that can bring in a family? It's easy. It's easy to use your words for positivity. So let's not get overly bogged down on all the negativity of our words, although it's certainly important to know about, but let's also focus on how much good we can do with our power of speech and how much warmth and love and connection we can add to the world with the power of our words. And I guess that's where we'll end for today. So any final thoughts or comments before we close?
Hi, Ruffy. So our son just got married on Sunday.
Oh, yes. And
thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'll send a picture. Anyway, so one of his friends gave a beautiful Devar Torah, which I thought was just so powerful about Shemira Salash and watching your speech. And he brought in from the last week's Parsha when they were talking about, I guess there's some kind of, when children are born, there's a certain kind of purification process. And then also it like connects with leprosy somehow, with the, you know, the Masora, the plague of the leprosy, that's not really leprosy. And he was saying that, you know, if you speak with your children when they're little and you're educating them from the start, they're modeling you, they're modeling your words, they're modeling your thoughts, and it will never come to that. And then he also brought in, it will never come to, you know, obviously, being shunned from the community, you know, having plagues on your house or your clothes or whatever, you know, the whole situation was. And then he also brought in, if you follow it, you'll never, the second Sarah Sedibra starts with, don't murder, right? If you're never going to upset anybody, you're never going to cause them pain. And the pain can be taken out in a terrible form, such as murder, right? So obviously those things happen otherwise, but I thought it was the way he brought it together. I'm not doing him justice, but just following, he said, following the first five commandments and the 10 commandments, well, now you'll never be able to, you'll never have, you know, the issue with, you know, chas v'shalom, someone causing someone that kind of pain that would elicit some kind of, you know, obviously repercussion. So, you know, Shmiras HaLashon goes very deep, not just hurting someone, you know, with your words, which really sticks and stones can break your bones, lames can never hurt you. It really does hurt because sticks and stones breaking your bones can heal. And sometimes words just, you can never heal from certain words.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing that up. And it's always a good reminder because it's always very easy to just slide into saying negative things, and hearing the opposite of saying positive things is just really very, you're encouraging, because we have a limited amount of words in our life that we can say, and using them for positive things is great.
Absolutely. So I want to wish everybody a very, very wonderful Shabbat and a beautiful holiday. And again, there's no class in a week, but I will see you in 2 weeks.
Amen. Everybody have a wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much. Thank you. Great seeing you.